This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Last week, talked a little bit about the Eightfold Path, this core formulation of the Buddha of how to find happiness, this path to end suffering and confusion. We mostly focused on the wisdom part of the path. The Four Noble Truths is broken down really into three tasks, actions. The first is to fully know suffering, to turn our attention completely and totally towards the truth of suffering in our life. The suffering of sickness, of aging, of death and grief. The suffering of living with impermanence, where everything is changing. And the good stuff goes away. The pleasant experiences don't stick around for long. And that's not always extreme suffering, but it's always a little stressful and somewhat unpleasant. Because of our tendency to cling, to grasp, and this human wiring of craving, the second truth. So our first task, know suffering and the causes of suffering fully. Turn towards understanding your direct experience, not intellectually, but in your bones. Second task, understanding that most of the suffering, all of the suffering, perhaps, in life, caused by craving, by our lack of ability to just accept it as it is and respond in a wise and skillful way. Accept that pain is a given in life. And that the only wise response to pain is compassion. And to develop compassion towards pain. To accept that pleasure is impermanent. The only wise relationship to impermanent anything is non-attached appreciation. Not to avoid pleasure, but to enjoy it and let it go. So the second task is to let go, is to relinquish craving. Not desire, not get rid of desire. Desire is not going anywhere. But craving as the extreme, as the experience of not only wanting, but clinging to. Attaching ourselves and attaching our happiness to getting. Craving says, I won't be happy until I obtain and keep. Desire says, I'm thirsty. It'd be nice to have a glass of water, but I could be okay dealing with this cotton mouth. I don't have to have it to be happy. Desire wants food, shelter, intimacy, wants, but doesn't crave it as the source of our happiness. Makes sense? Important to make that distinction. Sometimes in Buddhism we will hear what I believe is a mistranslation and say, desire causes suffering, an end to desire. Good luck. If we have to become desireless to be happy, we're all fucked forever. It's not going to happen. But the extreme we can work with. We can transform. We can relinquish the delusion that we have and keep, or we have to get rid of in order to be happy. Make sense? Second task, let go. Third task is the Eightfold Path, to be developed, to be cultivated, to be practiced, applied. Wise understanding and intention, we talked a lot about last week. Am I right? Did we talk about that last week?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Right, class?
Yeah.
All right. We're in Hollywood? Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Wise understanding and intention, bringing wisdom into our minds, into our hearts, into our lives, into what we know about the world, and how we intend to live in the world and in ourselves. Second, three factors, or the next section, is about ethical behavior. Sila is the Pali word, the Buddhist word. Wise speech, wise actions, and wise livelihood. These three form the basket of the Buddha's encouragement to develop wise way of being, way of acting, way of talking, communicating. And how we get our cash, our livelihood. Third basket, the last three, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Developing wisdom in all eight of these areas of our life, or we could say three areas, meditation, ethical behavior, and wisdom, outlook, perspective, understanding, is to be developed in order to end suffering and to live a life that is happy, content, to have a feeling of well-being in this world of impermanence, to learn to ride the waves of change. This is the prescription. I'd like to focus a little bit tonight on the middle section, this sila, ethical behavior of the Eightfold Path. All of this is necessary. You can't leave anything out. You can't be really wise and meditate a lot, but not have sila if you want to be happy. You can't have really good sila, but no wisdom. You can't be really good at meditating and have sila, but no wisdom. All of them have to go together. Meditation, ethical behavior, wise outlook, and intention. The Buddha several times had to correct people who got imbalanced on just trying to develop meditative attainments but weren't wise in their speech or in their action or livelihood. At times in the historical scriptures, he is rumored to have said things like, trying to walk this path without sila, without ethical renunciation, is like trying to row your boat across the river or lake while you're still tied to the dock. You won't get far. And the ethical behavior is pretty standard, universal. It's not, I don't think it's particularly Buddhist. Some pieces are. But it's a general encouragement to cause no harm. And I should actually clarify, cause no intentional harm. With the understanding that we will unintentionally cause a lot of harm by our mere existence in this world. Your carbon footprint will cause some harm. Not intentionally, you're not, you know, running your motor just for fun. Not out to destroy the planet as a hobby. But your mere existence is going to fuck up the planet a little bit. You're going to cause some harm unintentionally. Cause no intentional harm. Committing to a life of trying to live in a way that doesn't cause too much harm. to any living being. Beginning with how we communicate. How much harm or harmony or happiness is caused by the way we talk to each other? How much power there is in the word? Now, we can get really into this sort of perspective that says it's not what they say, it's how I respond. It's not what they do, it's how I respond. There's some truth to that, but there's also a lot of truth to what is said is very important. How it is said has a lot of power. We've all been deeply hurt by people being unskillful with their speech towards us. Unkind, angry, critical, judgmental, violent in speech causes harm. And we've all experienced how nice it is when we get kindness in speech, when people are praising, are generous, are loving. Wise speech is trying to speak in a way that is honest, that is useful, that is appropriate in its timing and delivery, and that is based on kindness, that is based on love, maybe even. Or at the very least, is not based on ill will or the intention to cause harm. That is not dishonest or divisive or harsh. And of course, it's way more than spoken word. It's every form of communication, including eye contact, the way we look at each other. Even body language communicates something to each other. So if I was editing the Buddha's Dharma talk here, I would say, let's not call it wise speech, let's call it wise communication, understanding that it's much more than speech. We are communicating in a lot of ways. These days, text message, email, twittering, whatever we're doing, it's all speech as far as this is concerned. Pretty straightforward, huh? Wise speech, but really hard to be careful, to be mindful enough about not only what am I saying, where is it coming from? Am I reacting out of greed, out of anger, out of fear? Am I really communicating something that is rigorously honest, appropriately timed, and useful for the recipient of this communication? Do we even pause enough to think about what we're saying and why? So, of course, this is where, and all of the Eightfold Path connected, without mindfulness, we will mindlessly speak in an unwise way. So mindfulness is a conjoining factor of right speech or of wise speech. We have to be paying attention to not only what we're saying, but why are we saying it? What is our intention behind this action of speech? Now, one of the reasons that this whole section on ethical behavior is so important to our liberation, to our happiness, to our freedom from suffering, is because of the truth of karma. That every action has a consequence. And unwise communications were responsible for the harm that they cause. When we're dishonest, when we're judgmental, when we're unskillful in our speech, we own that. We don't get away with it. We own it. And so a huge part of practicing mindful speech and wise communication isn't only as an act of generosity and altruistic so that you're not hurting your friends and family and co-workers and world that we live in, but it's also so that we're not hurting ourselves, so that we're not creating suffering while we're on this path to end suffering. Make some sense? Before I move on, anything about wise speech, sometimes called right speech. And so what's being said here is that there is wrong speech, there is unwise speech, and we have to acknowledge that and that we are most likely guilty of it quite often. I will have a little aside, maybe not important for this room, but there is a place in wise speech where the Buddha says to abstain from harsh speech. And often traditionally, swearing is considered harsh speech. Shit, right? And very often, if our intention behind cussing, swearing, can be harmful, for sure. Very often, fuck is used as a sword to hurt someone. But not always. I'm not comfortable with just lumping it always into, oh, swearing is always wrong speech. For me, it feels really clearly depending on the intention behind it, how it's being used. What's going on underneath? What is your intention with this? Because I swear a lot, and very rarely am I swearing in order to hurt someone or with the intention of violence. But I'm clear that often it's just an exclamation point. It's the sign of a poor vocabulary. And maybe even laziness of actually finding the right word. Habit. But very rarely is it coming, for me, from a harsh place. Sometimes it is. For sure, sometimes it is. But not every time we swear is it wrong speech or unskillful. My opinion. Some would disagree.
So, my normal state is very talkative. And so, sometimes when I'm frustrated, angry, sad, tired, any of those emotions, I increasingly have been more quiet because it just gives me some time to reflect versus just saying something out of regret. But my silence is being perceived as harmful. Mm. And I've had people say that it comes across as cold because that's normally so talkative. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to carve out this space for myself, but it's being perceived as hurtful. So I'm not sure how to reconcile that. Mm.
That's a difficult one. And I don't know if this is helpful or not, but technically, from this perspective, we are only responsible for our true and honest intentions and not people's perceptions. So we have to check in, because there is the difference. Sometimes, I'm sure you've been guilty of, and as all of us, the silent treatment. Intentionally causing harm by omission. And you're responsible for that inaction, that action of omission. And other times, intention is really just like, I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I'm going to say something mean, and I'm not trying to hurt you, I'm actually trying not to hurt you. I have a very positive intention by not talking to you right now. And then we're not really responsible for their perception of that if your intention is pure. And that's what I started with. Like, unintentionally, we're still going to hurt each other. Sometimes. But we have to be really rigorously honest about what our intention is. Because it's really easy to justify and to say, I'm just, need some space, but there's a little piece in there that says, and I'm glad you're suffering about the silence. Right? So we have to be careful. Next level of ethical behavior that we're encouraged to develop, and right speech, wise speech, lifetime of development, of practice, of failure. Not be perfect. But are we trying? Are we going in the direction of trying to be wise and careful with our communications? And then our actions. All of our actions. And this is traditionally where the five precepts come in, where the Buddha says, if you really want to follow this path and develop this kind of wisdom and liberation in your life, important to, at the very least, abstain from killing, lying, stealing, causing harm with your sexuality, and misusing drugs and alcohol. In general, again, it's not so Buddhist. Maybe the abstaining from killing. I think a lot of philosophies and religions and worldviews have justified and rationalized killing. And saying it's okay to kill animals and it's okay to kill insects and if they insult your religion, it's okay to kill people. Right? Buddhism, radically nonviolent. As ethical, moral guideline number one. Nonviolence towards all living beings, from the tiniest insect to the most grotesque human being. All living beings to be met with kindness, compassion, forgiveness, and non-harming, nonviolence. But not stealing, not lying, being careful with our sexual energy. Pretty universal. And clearly we understand causing karma. You lie, you steal, you cheat, you get too loaded, you'll lie and steal and cheat. And maybe kill. The only one that isn't so clearly causing harm is the precept around intoxication, right? Clearly, if you kill, that causes harm. Stealing, lying, causing harm with your sexuality through some form of dishonesty or any form of force or manipulation. The intoxicant precept and action around intoxicants doesn't make so much sense because in and of itself, is it bad karma to take a bong hit in the morning? Could it be? Doesn't seem to be hurting anybody except for maybe our brain cells. And so one of the ways that the Buddha's encouragement to abstain from, I said misuse, but and maybe there are some wise uses of medicinal medicines. But the recreational drug use, the Buddha kind of says, alcohol use, he says, if you're serious about ending suffering, you're going to need to be mindful as often as possible, all of the time. It's going to be a really good idea to abstain from anything that is going to interfere with your mindfulness, such as intoxicating liquids and substances that are going to interfere with the ability to be present. And because when we're intoxicated, we're more likely to kill, steal, lie, cheat. More likely to cause some negative karma for ourselves when we are not in our right mind. When we're not in full control of our faculties. So as well as taking on a practice of meditation, and taking on a practice of being careful with our communication, we're asked to practice some level of renunciation. That there are going to be things that we probably enjoy doing a lot, like gossiping. Love gossiping. So powerful to talk shit, right? Just feeds the ego in such a great way to gossip. I know this about so and so, and let me tell you. At one point, I always mess this up. The Buddha said something like, we can measure our wisdom based on how much we are doing things that we don't necessarily like to do, but we know lead to our long-term welfare. Think about that for a moment. How often are you doing, taking actions that you don't necessarily enjoy all the time, but that you know are good for you? Meditating.
Cardio.
Exercising. Eating healthy food. Drinking enough water. And the spiritual disciplines doing, studying Dharma, practicing Dharma, applying. Being of service. Maybe you don't always like being kind and generous. You don't always enjoy it. But you know being kind and generous is for your own welfare, long term. So he said, compare what you're doing that you don't necessarily like to do to what you are not doing, abstaining from, that you really enjoy, but that you know do not lead to your long-term welfare. So practice versus renunciation. And think about for a moment, how much renunciation do you have in your life? How many things do you know aren't so good for you, but you really like them? But you choose to let go of the gossiping, to let go of the intoxicants, of the couch potatoing, of the whatever, A, B, C. What do we renounce? For our own long-term welfare, and perhaps for the welfare of this world, this planet, each other. Lastly, as an overview, speech, actions, and maybe a nicer way to talk about wise action isn't just in renunciation, but a commitment to being generous, a commitment to being honest, a commitment to being kind and compassionate, to protecting life, to protecting relationships, to being really careful with our sexuality, to protecting each other, protecting ourselves. And the third section of our ethical behavior is just the reminder that this extends to how we earn money. Sometimes there can be that feeling of like, well, it's just my job to kill people. I don't do it for fun. It's not a hobby. I'm an assassin. I wouldn't do it if there was other jobs out there. But I meditate every day before I kill. And I never lie. I'm not really honest about murder. So just acknowledging that it's all important, and what we do for work, we spend a lot of our life working. I don't know what the statistic is, but it's like most. If you're working full time, most of us are. And that's all day, 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours a week. That we're creating karma. Based on how we're talking to people, based on how we're acting and what we're doing. And so the Buddha said, be really careful about how you're earning money. Make sure it's not causing harm to this world, to living beings. I just recently figured out one of the words that he uses, and I never knew what it meant, is to abstain from usury. Mm. I never knew what that meant. I thought it was some sort of magic, witchcraft or something. Usury. Spells. Do you know what it means?
Yeah.
It's lending money.
Lending money. It's interest.
My whole lineage of Jews. The money lenders. Wrong. Livelihood.
We were forced into it.
I think it's
okay. By the Buddhists.
It's okay to lend it, but not for interest.
Interest. Usury means interest, or does it mean lending? It means
interest.
Benefiting from charging interest.
Yeah,
right. That's huge. Like our whole society is based on charging interest.
Muslims have the same belief.
I haven't looked into it that much. I don't quite get what the problem with charging interest is, but. Seriously.
It's a good inquiry.
It's what? It's my lineage, yeah. I just don't get it. Seriously. Do you?
It means a lot of interest.
A lot of? Usury, too much? Usury is like overcharging?
Inappropriate amount of
interest. Inappropriate.
4%, 5%, no problem.
15%.
Too much.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
A degree.
Okay, okay. I can get my mind around that. The inappropriate sort of abuse of power and, you know, taking more than is leverage. Okay, I get that. Loan sharking. Got it. Now you're speaking my language. I got it. Not killing. Not charging too much interest. Not selling people or flesh of animals. Again, I don't think it's so much about what not, I mean, there's a small list of what not to do, but all of us just thinking about what am I doing for a living, or if I'm still trying to figure out what my career path is, choosing something, hopefully that's not only abstaining from causing harm, but that's going to be creating some harmony, that's going to be of service, that's going to be helping people. Like the precepts, not just not killing, protecting life. I think it's important for us the same way to think about our livelihood, not just not causing harm, but trying to create goodness and a positive change on some level or another with our actions and our life's energy.
In my life, livelihood also means not doing harm to yourself. Mm. And so, in my family, my lineage, they all went to work in a little cubicle, and they saluted, you know, the boss every morning, and all wore the same clothes, and they hated it. Mm. They hated it. From the time they were 30 years old to the time they dropped dead with their gold watch, they hated it. So that's what I mean by harming yourself, and not doing no harm to myself.
Yeah. So tricky. I feel really fortunate in my own life. Because I know this is such a huge issue for people of to find a calling and a livelihood that supports their humanness and not fitting into the machine in a way that's just inhuman. I can remember my father telling me when I was a teenager, and I started working when I was about 13 because I wanted money. and he's like, you want money? Get a job. I can remember him telling me later when I was thinking about, well, what am I going to do when I grow up? He said, you know, you get all your best jobs. Or maybe he said for himself, he said, I got all my best jobs from volunteering. And this connotation, and actually pretty direct from my father, that said, if you wouldn't do it for free, you don't want to be stuck doing it full time. But that's a, you know, kind of maybe unrealistic for most people. I feel it's so incredibly fortunate that I like counseling people, and I would do it for free. So I became a psychotherapist. I like teaching the Dharma, and I do it for free. So I'm very fortunate to be supported as a Dharma teacher. I know that that's not true for everyone. That's sort of a little bit. But it's good to think about, I think, for everyone to think about. Is there something that I would volunteer for, that I would do for free, and I can get paid for? Is there something?
Well, I was just going to say that earlier, that sometimes we do have jobs. It may not be a terrible job. It may not be your dream job. That you kind of just go into the motions and like, well, you know, pay for my rent, whatever, but that volunteering idea, you know, a lot of times we all get too, you know, you think you're too busy, I can't make time and stuff, but even if you do it once a month or whatever you can do, you find that it kind of, you look forward to doing that, and then it makes your job not seem so bad because you've got something else you're doing that kind of fulfills you, mm-hmm. and then sometimes it can turn into more, or, you know, like you said, maybe turn into a job by different things you get involved with, so... I think it's been, I've done it, and it's been really helpful, you know, to get through that kind of drudgery of your daily job.
For sure. Service, engaged,
the people you
helping.
Need, people you're helping and stuff, so.
Now, yeah, I'll take another question, and then that's the last one for now.
Well, I'm a little bit of a dilemma that the job I have, I would do for free, so I really enjoy it. And the people I work with, are good people. But it's part of a very large company that
charges too much interest.
Well, no, questions some of their motives and some of the things they do, and how much of a part of that am I? How much of a part am I playing in that questionable world?
Is it the Department of Defense?
No, it's Disney.
It seems like in this day and age with corporate conglomerates, you know, Pepsi owns everything, that many, many people are in that dilemma where they enjoy what they do and actually they're specific, but that it's actually owned by the machine. And then we can even go to like, but if I work, I'm paying taxes, which is a death sentence on people in Afghanistan. So there is some level of harm by our mere existence and by our mere employment and our paying of taxes and our, on some level, for most, not for everyone. So we have to find our own way with that. Maybe it's harm reduction and it's sort of, can I bring real mindfulness and real positive intention to this work? To create a good work environment and put out a good product or whatever. But that's a, it's a dilemma. I don't have an answer for it. But my own feeling is we have to be careful not to get too stuck in causing absolute no harm and working for somebody that causes absolutely no harm. Because we will all be unemployed and in jail for not paying our taxes, and there's some acceptance of the culture that we live in without then justifying working for the Department of Defense. Or not that if you work for the Department of Defense that's automatically negative. So here's what I'd like to, we don't have so much time, but I know you're all thinking about this, and hopefully not just tonight, but you think about this in your life and as part of your practice and path. And you think about, I encourage you to think about, what is it that needs to be let go of? Look at some stuff that you know isn't really for your welfare, but you're kind of holding on to it. It's not so ethical. It doesn't really fit in wise speech or action or livelihood. You just really enjoy your job as an assassin and I'm not quite ready to give it up. What is it for you? It's not really congruent with your goals. Your goal of happiness. Your goal of freedom. Of liberation. Do you have a list already? Porn, yes, that's what I was talking about. Right? We all have the list, the honest. One of the ways. Yeah.
What about guilt? Can you, like,
what about,
take that? Can you have that?
Renounce guilt?
Like, you said you're sorry. You have to look
up. I don't quite understand you.
You said, like, you have a list of things you're not ready to give up.
Mm-hmm. And you're not ready to give it up?
Well, like, should. Yeah. How do you say goodbye to your guilt?
Hmm. I don't know. But there sometimes is, there is guilt, right, for sure. But there's also when that guilt is let go of. For me, guilt means that there's a negative judgment on ourselves about it. But even after that negative judgment, I'm bad because of, is forgiven, is let go of, there will remain regret. And sometimes we confuse regret for guilt. Sometimes it really is guilt and shame, which are unwholesome, unnecessary, extra suffering. From the Buddhist perspective, we should not try to get rid of regret. When we have done something unskillful, when we've caused harm, you should regret it. Without the "I'm a bad person because of it." Just, I was unskillful, it was unwise, I regret having caused harm in that way. That's a healthy emotion. Out of compassion for the harm I caused, I regret it. And not a critical judgment about, I'm a bad person. So, forgiveness of yourself and others, mostly of yourself, will lead to freedom from guilt. And the kind of not ready, that's why it tripped me up a little bit, because if you have the intention to be free from guilt, you have to also have the intention to, or the willingness to forgive. And then there's the practice of self-forgiveness, which will lead to a place of non-guilt and non-shame, but still a healthy sense of regret. It's like desire. You're not going to get free from desire, and you're not going to get free from regret. So we have to have a realistic view on our goals, on where we're heading. Does that help some? Yeah. But I don't even know if we have time. I was going to ask us to share some of this lists with each other. But if anybody is interested in... you know, there's a very powerful thing in expressing our intentions in a group. Every New Year's this community gets together and we do an intention setting ceremony. Remember, second factor of the Eightfold Path, a wise intention. In traditional Buddhist communities, there would be a gathering regularly where people admit fault, almost like a Buddhist confession. We say, you know, I'm really trying to be careful with my speech, but I just keep gossiping. I'm really trying to protect life, but I was meditating yesterday and I just smacked that mosquito without even thinking about it. I murdered that little son of a bitch. And so it's a very traditional thing that we don't really have in the West. People were all shy. People don't like to speak in big groups. But it's an important thing, and there's something really powerful in saying, I'm really committed to being more careful with my sexuality, to being more careful with my speech. I'm really committed to getting out of this life of dealing drugs, of using drugs. Of not, I have to be perfect today, but I'm committed on going in that direction. It is my intention to come more in harmony with the Dharma and to be more free from that which is causing negative reverberations in my heart, in my mind, in my life, that is obscuring my path, that is blocking my freedom. So if there's any stuff that's come to mind, we do have a little bit of time. I can't break you into small groups, but if there's anything that people want to talk about that you're intending, that you're heading towards, that has been brought up in this discussion of sila, of ethical behavior, there's some time for that to be shared with us.
Did you say that among the things that you... the Buddha, the occupations that the Buddha said not to participate in was selling meat?
Killing or profiting from death.
Didn't say anything about buying it.
Didn't say anything about buying it because it's not a livelihood. But it's definitely something to be considered. And to really be looked at. And I know we've had this conversation a little bit before. My own feeling is that there is some karma in purchasing and eating meat. Or maybe not eating, but certainly purchasing. Maybe there's a such thing as the sort of Buddhist vegetarian, which the real Buddhist vegetarian, which is I'd never purchase it, I would never kill it, but if it's offered to me, the karma isn't in the consumption, but in the participation with the death sentence itself. Roadkill, free game. Yeah.
Noah?
Yes.
Yeah. For example, in veggies, if I went to someone's household and all they were serving was meat, and I was very, very hungry and needed something to eat, you know, I've never done that yet, but, you know, is there any harm? I mean, not to myself, but in the Buddhist sense.
I don't think so from the Buddhist view. But more important for you to reflect on it and find out how it resonates for you. And could you do it without beating yourself up? Without the guilt? Without, I'm a bad person because I ate that cheeseburger.
Yeah.
Maybe not impossible, but yeah. So from the Buddhist view, no, there's not karma in that. But for you to decide, if it's going to hurt me because I'm going to judge myself so much about it, then probably better to just eat the bun. Yeah. Okay. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Any other questions about the meditation instructions or about anything presented?
I have a question.
Sure.
What about spontaneity?
In what sense?
Well, when you were talking about mindfulness. Mindfulness takes a little bit of stepping back and being mindful. And yet there's some joy and beauty and life in spontaneity. Mm. And that seems to be a really delicate path to negotiate, because sometimes with spontaneity, you can make big mistakes. So I just wondered if you had some thoughts about that.
I mean, I guess the goal is to train our minds and hearts so thoroughly that we're really coming from a place of kindness. That we really have non-harming as our guiding principle. And then spontaneity is going to hopefully unfold in a way that is not causing harm and that is kind and loving. I guess that that's the... And in the meantime, until we get there, knowing that in spontaneity, we're probably going to make some mistakes. We're probably going to cause some harm and say some things that maybe we catch after they've already escaped the tongue. In which case, we have the tool of amends and of, you know, asking for forgiveness and forgiving ourselves for not being... We have to be careful not to turn this into like I have to be perfect and I can't be spontaneous. And there's the humility that just knows, yeah, I'm going to fuck up. And I have the tools to clean it up when I do, I think. I would hope that we can come to the place, though, where we can trust ourselves enough to be completely spontaneous and know that we're not going to intentionally cause harm.
Compassion, pain.
Mm.
You know, like my leg fell asleep during the meditation. I don't understand how my compassion is for my leg.
It's really hard, right? Our built-in maybe survival instinct is shift. That hurts. Let me get rid of that pain. But you do know how to meet pain with mercy and compassion. Maybe someone that you really think about, someone that you really care about who has some sort of pain in their leg, a broken leg, say. And the way that you might feel towards their pain. Some empathy, some friendliness, some compassion, right? Can you get a sense of that? How you might feel to someone else's pain? And then trying to bring that attitude towards your own. The built-in relationship to our pain is aversion. It's our survival instinct. Aversion causes this whole extra level of anger and fear and suffering. The goal is to be able to meet our pain with acceptance, with friendliness, with the original word karuna is translated as a movement in your chest, a quivering of your heart in response to pain. So rather than this sort of clenched jaw, I fucking hate pain, to a softness and an openness and a loving relationship to pain is the goal. It takes a while to get there, right? It doesn't even make sense at first. But what I hope does make sense is that our relationship to just hating it doesn't work. And so we have to find an alternative. And the alternative that the Buddha found, and I think is universal offering to us, is that of learning to be friendly towards pain rather than aversive towards it, compassionate towards it. You will get there simply by trying. First, understanding, right? First factor of the Eightfold Path. Understand. Meet pain with compassion. Second, have the intention, the goal. My goal, I understand I'm supposed to meet pain with compassion, but I don't know how. But it's my goal. My aim is to meet pain with compassion. By simply being pointed in that direction and the repetitive trying, eventually you'll come to the place where you're sitting here and your leg falls asleep and you don't hate it. It's just unpleasant. And you tolerate it and you accept it and it's not a problem at all. You have compassion for it. Will happen through that goal. Does that make any sense?
Completely.
It's so simple, I think, in some ways, but it's so foreign to how we're wired. Anyways, these are just my ramblings and thoughts about sila, about the importance of ethical behavior. If you want to get across the river, please untie your rowboat so that you have the possibility of crossing over to the other side. And each of us has to realize that we do probably have some threads still tied to the dock. And what's it going to take to untie them, to let go of them? with all of this stuff, trust yourself and your own investigation of these teachings and of your actions and speech and livelihood, rather than trying to put some religious overlay on your life. Really just look at your speech, your actions, your livelihood, and your karmic reverberations from what you're doing. The Buddha encourages us to question all of these teachings and this path. So I encourage you to question it and to come up with your own answers. May our wise speech, actions, and livelihood bring about a positive change to this world. See you next time.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.